temperatures are forecast to stay in the low 70s for the rest of the day under cloudy skies. From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Type player plays his cards right. A real gangster type player never runs his mouth, because real gangsterized players don't start fights.
Hi, and welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker.
We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Chris Garlock.
I'm Elise Bryant. On today's show,
it imagines that John Brown mysteriously and unexplainably reemerges in the Virginia, West Virginia area, right where he was hanged. And he gets arrested by the local sheriff with the support of a local farmer. They're afraid that he's going to stir up the Black Lives Matter crowd.
Longtime union organizer Gene Bruskin is back with a brand new labor musical, The Return of John Brown. We'll talk to him about why that 19th century abolitionist is relevant in the 21st century.
So push come to shove, and pretty soon we had us a war down there in Mingo County, which in them days was known as Bloody Mingo.
And remember, next Friday is Hawaiian Shirt Day.
Okay, but I could set the building on fire.
Two of our favorite labor movies are back in this week's DC Labor Film Fest preview. I talk with AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center Director Todd Hitchcock and Abby Algar, Director of AFI Programming, about Mate One and Office Space, which screen on May 20th and May 22nd, respectively.
I want to let people know that people, men and women of color, had a vital role in the success of that in earlier days. I want to make sure that when I'm gone from Mammoth Cave National Park, that the story doesn't go away again.
In our final segment with the wonderful America Works podcast, we'll meet Jerry Bransford, a seasonal tour guide at Kentucky's Mammoth Cave National Park. Members of Mr. Bransford's family began working as cave guides in the 1830s. Like many of the early guides, they were African Americans. And through their knowledge of the cave, they became local, national, and even international celebrities despite being enslaved. Generations of Bransfords continue to guide tourists through Mammoth Cave after they achieved freedom in 1865.
That's all ahead on the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Here's the show.
Hey, this is Bob Odie from Million Dollar Organizer. We're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
Let me give you some advice. I will make it real concise. Did you say I'll pay the ultimate price? You can put a man on trial, make him walk that extra mile, but you can't hang the same man twice. It ain't right.
Gene Bruskin spent 45 years as a labor union organizer and campaign coordinator before retiring in 2012. Since then, he's written and produced three musicals for and about working class people. Pray for the Dead, a musical tale of morgues, moguls, and mutiny. The Moment Was Now, a musical about a fictitious meeting between Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, and other important historical figures who played a major role in the labor movement and the struggle for racial and social justice.
And his latest, The Return of John Brown, which will have four staged readings in the next few weeks. The readings are free, and you'll find details at laborheritage.org. So, Gene Bruskin, give me the elevator pitch on your latest labor musical.
So this is called The Return of John Brown, and it imagines that John Brown mysteriously and unexplainably reemerges in the Virginia, West Virginia area, right where he was hanged. And he starts trying to sort of get his bearings and figure out how he got there, because he was hanged in 1859. And he starts walking around and he gets arrested by the local sheriff with the support of a local farmer. They're afraid that he's going to stir up the Black Lives Matter crowd because he looks just like John Brown, but they can't imagine he really is, but he says he is. And so they lock him up, and he ends up going on trial, and the judge sort of reluctantly takes it on. And he has a trial where his lawyers are the great-grandson of Frederick Douglass and the great-great-granddaughter of Harriet Tubman, both of whom ancestors were close to John Brown. They find out he's in jail, and they come down to defend him from Philly. And so the trial is essentially an argument about whether John Brown was right in fighting white supremacy, and did Abraham Lincoln really learn from John Brown, and what is the history, and do we still have a problem? And the prosecutor says, no, all we have is simple prejudice. We don't have any problem. And this is all done, this whole thing is done with a whole series of musical numbers. And what happens is that the farmer who's trying to prosecute John with, along with the sheriff, it turns out that he's getting his farm taken over by a pipeline owner who's also trying to take over the local farms of the Black farmers, and they won't, and a white guy won't talk to the Black farmers. So he's playing them off against each other. So it rolls out into a whole different plot direction, and John Brown unites the white and Black farmers who help him escape and save their farms. So it's a musical comedy with a lot of history in it, but it's really with present concepts.
So your cultural work is always deeply rooted in history. And if you talk a little bit about what are the sort of the opportunities and the challenges of taking complex history like, you know, John Brown and abolition and racism today, and turning that into something that is relevant to today's audiences.
Right.
Something.
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris.
But the other thing
the
other thing that you always do is you try to make it funny, and you have songs. Those are three. I could see you doing just doing a straight version of that would be one thing, but to try and make it funny and have tunes is a pretty high bar.
It is a high bar, but it's all the same answer in a way. First of all, the way I came to this particular play is that my last play was about Reconstruction, which took a lot of these issues on. And since then, just looking at all the incredible racial tension and racism that continues to divide the union movement, the popular movements of every kind, looking at history, I decided if there's one character in one white guy character in history besides Abe Lincoln who people are most likely to have heard about, it's John Brown. And as it turns out, he's the right character, but many people who I would have expected have heard of him haven't heard of him. Part of constructing this play, even though it takes place in the present, is that I have to figure out how to work in the history of who is John Brown so that I cannot assume that. So the opening of the play is the actual moment in the actual words of when John Brown is hanged. The court, the judge's ruling, and the music in the background, and John Brown's final words, which we have. And my thinking about all this is that this racism in particular is a really difficult thing for people to hear. And part of the fight back against it in the schools is it makes people feel bad. And aside from why that's a phony argument, I think partly it's something that even within the labor movement, people have a hard time discussing. And so what I'm trying to portray in this show is you see the white farmer protagonist who's part of the initial arrest of John Brown end up changing in the course of this as he realizes that his own racism is stopping him from saving his land, which is the only thing he has in the world. But in order to do this, I can't just come across and make heavy kind of lectures because people can't hear it. They don't want to hear it. It's not interesting. But if you make it funny and you have the music, then people can take it in. And it's also not coming at them. It's up there on the stage. And then at the end of my shows, we always have conversations. So one example of this is that when John Brown goes into court, the judge is trying to sort of read him the rules, and John Brown is pushing back, and the judge gets angry at him and said, listen, if you don't behave yourself and we find you guilty, we're going to hang you again. And so this, so John Brown leaps up, and in his, this is a lot of the song is his own words talking about his life. But what the way he starts it, it's a banjo song. And he gets up and said, basically sings this song. You can't hang the same man twice. It ain't nice. And he's locking arms and it's like a square dance. And the judge is banging on the panel and everything.
Let me give you some advice. I will make it real concise. Say I'll pay the ultimate price. You can put a man on trial, make him walk that extra mile, but you can't hang the same man twice. It ain't nice, but you can't hang the same man twice. Don't you know you can't hang a man so? They tried it once and here I am, unhurt. Admit it, just quit it. God firmly will forget it. Blood of the slaves on his skirt. But you may well be of a decent sort. You may love your family and friends. You've been wrong all along. The time's come and gone. This nation must now make amends. Let me give you some advice. I will make it real concise. Did you say I'll pay the ultimate price? That had no rights you were bound to respect. Don't fight it, just write it. It's time to decide it. I'm back to say there's more than I expect. Now I may be a ghost or a vision, or I may be your worst nightmare. Don't abuse or refuse, or you I will accuse. Be sitting right up in the chair. Let me give you some advice. I will make it real concise. You say I'll pay the ultimate price. You can put a man on trial, make him walk that extra mile, but you can't hang the same man twice. It ain't right. You can't hang the same man twice.
This sort of courthouse scene is really serious, has historical raps versus white versus black versions of history, but it's also got this sort of comedy and subplots in it. And so this it sort of all comes together. And here the history is important because of who he is and what he represents, but it's really a present day story. And the whole point is, can I make this relevant? So what if John Brown was hanged trying to free the slaves in an armed uprising? What about today?
So I want to talk about two things. One is you talked about how the labor movement has trouble talking about racism. And I think, and also implied in what you're talking about or in your approach, is that I think we also have trouble with having a sense of humor. I've heard this from our young folks and people that are getting into it, that we're like, we're too damn serious. And it seems to me that you're really trying to confront that. And so how do you find, and that was a good example, but when you're doing this, how do you find humor? I think if, you know, John Brown is not somebody that I think folks would necessarily.
He's not a stand-up comedian, as it turns out.
or maybe he is, and we didn't know. But I mean, so when you're looking for that, what are the kind of things that you're looking for to find humor in a serious subject?
Partly the way this worked is that when I decided to do something about John Brown, there's many books and even several plays about John Brown. And he basically got black and white people together right here in the state of Maryland, outside of Harper's Ferry, and staged a raid, an armed raid, which didn't succeed to free the slaves. And so there's much of that written and many details of his life. I thought that's already been done, and that's not relevant. It's long back. It's relevant that it happened. But I thought, well, what if he was here? That would shake him up. And then I thought, what kind of John Brown? There are many John Browns. He's painted in history, some as a religious, you know, fanatic, of which we have a lot of them today, but and as a terrorist, and he was hanged basically as a terrorist. But I saw him more as somebody who's like mischievous. And once I decided I was going to make him mischievous, then I thought, then let's have him have some fun. And his attitude is sort of, he's serious, but on the other hand, you know, he's got a sense of humor. And I created a ridiculous situation. And the situation is that he appears today. So right away, it's almost like a magical realism thing, because he doesn't understand how he got here, and neither does anybody else. But what he represents is still here. So there is this sort of silly, unexplainable subplot that keeps coming up the whole time, where the sheriff and the farmer who arrest him, they can't figure out what to call him, what to charge him with. Zombie terrorism. Should we charge him with that? And what about carrying an unregistered rifle? Well, the rifle's from 1859. So there's this whole silly scene with the sheriff who has a really essentially an inferiority complex, but he tries to build himself up. So when you see his office, he's got a giant picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger on the wall. And when he goes to arrest John Brown, he comes in riot gear. And John Brown's there. What's that thing you got on your head? And why are you all dressed up like that? Are you in the army? Just giving myself permission to have fun with what a mischievous John Brown would be like in a crazy situation.
Let's talk about the songs. There's a number of songs. Maybe you could just tell me some of the favorite ones or things that you think bring out some of the main themes in the show.
Yeah. So I think that when John Brown is in jail, he's sitting in his cell, and he's basically trying to figure out what's going on here. He's locked up, and he reaches into his pocket and he finds an old rumpled up piece of paper. And it turns out it's his final words right before they hang him. And these are his final words. And so John Brown sings his song, a musical song, May It Please the Court. And it's his final words of what he said to the judge, where he talks about what he did and he didn't do. And he ends up saying, if I had waged this war on behalf of the rich, I would be being honored and cherished instead of hanged. So that sort of sets the tune on what his perspective was and what he did. When he's in jail, when he's on trial, the argument becomes, what really has our history been? And that's a huge argument in all the courts. And the white sheriff gives the sort of white man's burden history, which is the complete white version. We did everything. and we were nice to you. What are you complaining about? And that's done as a rap. And then the counter argument is, which is called the new Jim Crow, which is done by the two black lawyers, the great grandchildren of Douglas and Tubman. And they're doing a counter rap. And so this is what's going on amidst the chaos of the court. Later on, toward the end, when the action turns to John Brown's escape plan and the black and white farmers in his cell, and he tries to convince the black farmers to let him help them unite with the white farmer and get their and protect their land. So there's the black farmers, they can't figure out who the hell this guy is, but they know about John Brown. And so they say, basically, don't mess with us. Don't be messing with us. But because we want our land. And then they sing this, really, it turned out I have some great singers singing it, but we want our land, it's about freedom. We want our land, it's about dignity. And it's the black work farmers singing the history of how black people have had their land taken from them. And they're basically saying at the end of it, so don't you be messing with us. And they walk out.
We want our land.
And then in finally, the song at the end is a retake the words of what became a famous song during the Civil War for the Northern soldiers, John Brown's Body, and updating the words to the play. And they are singing sort of John Brown's body lies a moldering in his grave. His truth goes marching on. And the whole cast comes out. And that turns into Solidarity Forever. And that's the end of the play.
John Brown taught us that we've got a lot to say. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Life's a mercy can
be. You've got previews coming up. And I want you to give us a schedule. But if you could talk a little bit about, with your previous shows, tell us a story or two. You remind me of Ralph Fasanella, who was very adamant. He was a painter, but he didn't want, of course, they do now hang in museums, but he would be upset about that. He wanted his work to hang in union halls and places where people could see them. And I feel like, I don't think you'd object to having your shows on Broadway, but I don't think that's really your goal here.
No, really, I decided that partly because of my earlier love of theater before I got into the labor movement and when I was growing up, that this is a great way to educate people. You can say things that if I said them, if I read them in a speech or if I wrote it up, people would just not hear it. And so the whole idea is to bring the audiences who don't come to these plays. And because theater is like opera in many people's minds today, it's just too expensive. And for the average bus driver or waitress or worker, it's for somebody else. So my first play was called Pray for the Dead, a musical tale of morgues, moguls, and mutiny. And it was about a fictitious uprising of funeral workers in a fictitious country that led to an uprising of workers in all over the nation. And what I did is I worked with a bunch of unions, the Transit Worker Union, 1199 in Baltimore, the Machinist Union, to put the play on when the union, in the union halls, and when the unions were having conferences and meetings of different kinds, so that I brought the play to the workers. Because I knew that if you just say, come to a musical, even if they have to get in a bus and go somewhere, they might not come. And so we had union audiences at almost every show. And things happened, like at the Machinist Hall in Western Maryland, Southeastern Maryland. At the end of the show, one of the workers came up to me and said, I work in Anheuser-Busch, and I just want to say that that's the way they treat us. And at one point, I don't want to admit this, but I had some tears in my eye because I felt exactly the same way, you know. And I thought, okay, bingo. Home run. And my second play, The Moment Was Now, which is takes place in 1869 during Reconstruction, about the multiple movements of the Black Freedom Movement, the Women's Movement, and the emergence of the National Labor Union and the Modern Labor Movement. We did one of our performances. We brought in students from two high schools, and we had, 150 people, audience of like 10th, 11th, and 12th graders. And I was just really nervous that they just thought they were there because I thought maybe they came because they didn't want to take a test if they stayed home. And one of the songs was Ain't I a Woman, which is Sojourner Truth's famous speech, but I made some adjustments and a incredible singer, Julia Nixon, sang it. And she just took off. Ain't I a woman? It was incredible. And I looked out in the audience, and this whole row of what looked like 14, 15-year-old girls stood up with their arms waving in the air like they were in church. And I thought, if Sojourner Truth's 1846 or whatever speech sung by Julia Nixon in a play in 2020 can get that row of kids up, I'm happy.
Give us the details on the preview schedule.
Okay, so there's going to be four staged readings, which means that these are rehearsed readings with the music, but not a full production. So people aren't in full costumes. We don't have lots of scenery, but the whole show is there. And it's an opportunity for people to see it and comment on it so that we can get the feedback and make it better. The first performance is going to be on April 26th at the Mount Zion Methodist Church in Baltimore at 7:30. The second performance is going to be at the MLK Library in downtown D.C., the main library. And then the next week on the 5th and 6th, on the afternoon, Saturday and Sunday afternoon, the play will be performed at the famous John Brown Historical House, where he staged a raid on the lawn with the house right there in the background. And it'll be part also of a tour of the John Brown House.
All right. We will have all of those dates and links on our website, laborheritage.org. Click on calendar. Gene Bruskin, congratulations and thanks so much.
Yeah, and thank you, Labor Heritage Foundation, and also Teaching for Change, for co-sponsoring this. Two great organizations I'm pleased to work with.
You're listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. Up next, the DC Labor Film Fest is coming up, and we've been previewing this year's lineup with AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center Director Todd Hitchcock and Abby Algar, Director of AFI Programming. Here's Chris.
Hit were 19 and 20 in the southwest field and things was tough. The miners was trying to bring a union to West Virginia and the coal operators and their gun thugs was set on keeping them out.
Corporate account.
Hello, Peter. What's happening? We have sort of a problem here. Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
May 20th and 22nd, back-to-back labor classics. The 20th, we have Mate One, and the 22nd, we have Office Space, which now that I look at it, guys, it's a little bit of an emotional roller coaster there, but I'm sure you know what you're doing. Todd, why don't you start us off with Mate One, which, of course, we've shown before with the director. We have a special reason for showing it this year.
Well, I mean, it's maybe the title we have shown the most in 20 or so years of the Labor Film Festival, but there's reasons for that. It is an absolute classic. John Sayles, and like our conversations with Ken Loach and Martin Ritt, this is not his only laborific film in his lengthy filmography. There are others as well, but this is, I think, the one that's at the top of the list. The setting has to do with a miner strike in West Virginia in, where are we, early 1920s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the brutal, and I mean brutal, suppression of that strike. It's got tons of atmosphere in terms of that time in America and that very small town and isolated part of the country, and just showing the way in which that this company, this business dominates, the deck is stacked in their favor, and they dominate not only the job, but really kind of the whole world around the job in this town and in this neck of the woods. Terrific work from the cast, some actors that our listeners will absolutely recognize, like James Earl Jones and David Strait Tern and Mary McDonnell, who was in a number of interesting films around that time. Also, I got to make a plug for a young Will Oldham, who's the sort of oddball preacher, young preacher and narrator of the film. Will Oldham, for some music fans, is a very important name in sort of the indie rock, indie folk zone, recording both under his own name and his pen name of Bonnie Prince Billy, but he's had a long songwriting career. So those who know, with occasional acting along the way, including here. He's also in The Bike Riders, actually, which is an interesting film that will be opening this summer, something to look for in June. Starring Tom Hardy and Austin Butler, and
Jodie Comer. Is that who?
Jodie Comer, yes.
Yeah. Jodie Comer.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of other great character actors. So hopefully we're talking about Matewan, and the listeners, many are familiar already. If you have not seen this film before, please, I hope this May 20 date fits your schedule and you can see it here. Just an absolute landmark film in John Sayles' career. Absolutely at the top of the list when we talk about labor films. The Library of Congress has recognized it recently, adding it to the National Film Registry. And yes, you could see this at home and appreciate it on your television screen, maybe even your gigantic television screen. But really, it's the kind of film you should see on the big screen at a theater and really give yourself over to the whole experience.
Hit were 19 and 20 in the Southwest field, and things was tough. The miners was trying to bring a union to West Virginia, and the coal operators and their gun thugs was set on keeping them out. Them was hard people, your coal miners. Then they wasn't nobody who wanted to cross. So push come to shove, and pretty soon we had us a war down there in Mingo County, which in them days was known as Bloody Mingo. And that's where it all come to a head, there on Tug Fork, in the town of Matewan.
I'm remembering, guys, that the last time we showed it was when Sayles was in town to introduce it, and which was terrific. I have to tell you that, you know, we all went out to dinner with John, which was fabulous and wonderful to sit with John and talk with him, and a special thing. But it meant that I did not get to see it in Theater mm-hmm. One at the AFI. And I have to tell you that when I was given the choice of going to dinner with y'all and John and watching the film, it was not an easy decision, honestly. And so I'm very happy to be able to not have that choice, and I can go sit with everybody else and watch the film this time. So I am really looking forward to it.
So what you're saying is you feel the need to see it again.
I absolutely feel the need to see it again. And then I'm definitely going to need to see 2 days later on May 22nd, Office Space. And Abby, I'm going to throw this to you because I thought your connection to the whole technology issue that we first raised with Modern Times in our discussion about AI, I'm feeling that. So do you want to talk a little bit about Office Space, which is another classic labor film? It's the only film that we, for a while there, and I don't remember exactly how many years, but for a number of years, we showed it every year. I think we took a couple of years off, but it's back in rotation.
We've shown it at least 10 times. So I have to amend what I said before. Matewan is the film we've shown the most that's not Office Space.
Good point.
Office Space is in a class of its own, and we've shown it at least 10 times.
And this year, I mean, I think this year is special because it's actually the, believe it or not, the 25th anniversary.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. So,
but we're not any older, are we, guys?
No. Yeah, so that's as good a reason as any to show it. But yeah, it's a fantastic workplace comedy, and it kind of launched a few careers. I mean, I think Jennifer Aniston was known at this point, but, you know, she's in here and really kind of makes a mark. And then, you know, obviously Stephen Root is fantastic in this film, and Gary Cole. And I think it's just a great workplace satire from Mike Judge. And we did a little retrospective, didn't we, a few seasons back in the festival of Mike Judge. And, you know, he has a great filmography also, but this is probably the best known and most beloved among his great comedies.
And remember, next Friday is Hawaiian Shirt Day.
Okay, but I could set the building on fire.
We need to talk about your flair.
Well, I have 15 pieces on.
15 is the minimum. Brian, for example, has 37 pieces of flair on today. And a terrific smile.
Two things that sort of occur to me. One is, because I've seen it so many times, and it is always wonderful to not only for me to see it again, but to introduce it to so many young folks who come out of the screening saying they've only seen it, you know, on their, you know, laptop or whatever, and to see it in a theater with an audience is such a different experience. But two things I wanted to say: one is seeing Stephen Root, who I've seen, you know, he's become quite, you know, the full-fledged star actor, usually in just really interesting roles. And then you go back and you see him here, and he's almost unrecognizable in some ways, which, of course, is one of the characteristics of a truly great actor. But I just love seeing him. I saw him in something recently where he was just malevolent as hell, mm-hmm. which he can be in that sort of very classic Stephen Root. Stephen Root was one of the ones who came when we brought a couple of the actors. Couldn't have been a nicer guy, by the way. Mm-hmm. But to see him in the wonderful role in this film, and then to see him in his more recent things. The other thing that I'm thinking, Office Space, I mean, I was out at my office yesterday, and I go maybe once a week now. So many people in downtown DC is in many ways just a ghost town still, even a couple years later. And there's a real question right now about what's going to happen with offices in these times. Seriously, I mean, it is not back to normal by any means. The metro is way, way down. And so it's interesting. It's, you know, I think it, in some ways, there's almost a little nostalgia. Not me personally, you know, I'm okay with once a week in the office. But do either of you want to talk a little bit about that? It's just, that just occurred to me. I'm just throwing it out there.
No, I think that's a great point. Certainly nostalgia. And I think you were talking about introducing this, you know, maybe to new people who haven't seen it before, new generations. And if you think about it, there's a whole kind of generation of people in the workplace who have, you know, just entered it at the beginning of COVID. And office culture is maybe not familiar to them. And so I would be interested to hear those people's thoughts after seeing Office Space. Because of course it's very familiar to all of us, and you know, the various frustrations and all of that stuff. But yeah, to a generation of workers, it's maybe quite an alien concept.
What's an office?
Yeah. We need a Zoom. This, you know, the 2024 version of Office Space would be a Zoom room.
But that's not going to be as good. How could it be? And Abby, we've seen some Zoom movies.
We have, and we don't need to see anymore.
That we don't need to see anymore, exactly. The film does such an amazing job skewering that office culture, cubicle land, bureaucracy, forms, why can't the damn printer work, reality that we've all lived at times or
continue to have.
Or today. You're right, Chris, that's not the given in 2024 that it was when the film was made. I follow what you're saying about the nostalgia. I've even started to see think pieces popping up. I think more thinking is needed, but it's interesting that this moment in time and changes, yes, but I don't think it's going to completely go away as a concept. I think seeing it now 25 years on and in this moment of hybrid working and work from home will add something to it as well.
I don't like my job and I don't think I'm going to go anymore.
One of these days I just kick this piece of...
I'm thinking now it might be more fun to just get fired. And I've always wondered what that would take.
Oh, Peter, listen.
Well, it looks like you've been missing quite a bit of work lately.
Well, I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
That's just a straight shooter with upper management written all over.
Hey, this is Gene Lance from Dallas, Texas, where we have the Workers Beat and the Workers Beat Extra. I'm proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. More than 200 labor radio and podcast shows across the country and around the world.
Here's our final segment, a visit with tour guide Jerry Bransford from the America Works podcast, which you can find and follow on your favorite podcast platform.
Welcome to America Works, interviews with contemporary American workers throughout the United States, collected by the library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This is AFC staff folklorist Nancy Gross, and this America Works episode features excerpts from a longer interview with Jerry Bransford, a seasonal tour guide at Kentucky's Mammoth Cave National Park. The world's longest cave system, Mammoth Cave has been a tourist attraction since soon after the region was settled by Europeans in the late 18th century. Members of Mr. Bransford's family began working as cave guides in the 1830s. Like many of the early guides, they were African Americans, and through their knowledge of the cave, they became local, national, and even international celebrities despite being enslaved. Generations of Bransfords continued to guide tourists through Mammoth Cave after they achieved freedom in 1865. Jerry's ancestor, Will Bransford, even represented Mammoth at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. But the family's multi-generational relationship with the cave was abruptly severed in 1941, when the cave became a U.S. national park, and in the ensuing reorganization, all African-American workers were dismissed. As Mr. Bransford explained to folklorist Brent Bjorkman during this interview for the Occupational Folklife Project documenting ranger lore, he started working as a guide after retiring from a successful corporate career because he felt it was his duty to come back to Mammoth to make sure park visitors learned about the important contributions his family and other African-American cave workers made in the exploration and development of this celebrated natural wonder.
I am Jerry Bransford, and I'm a seasonal tour guide for Mammoth Cave National Park. Well, my connection to the park goes back in the 1830s to Thomas Bransford of Nashville. I didn't know the entire story, but I knew three generations of Bransfords, even as a young kid, per my daddy, uncle, and aunts and kinfolk. But I found out there was actually a generation and a half more Bransfords than I really knew about. Well, I actually started tour guiding to 2004, and I had already been invited to Mammoth Cave National Park for History Month that I would do a presentation there in the auditorium, and that really developed my interest. And being fascinated with my family's story, I realized that there was even more than I knew about it, and I was really motivated to tell everybody of kind of what I know and some things that happened to my ancestors. Some things were happy, and then as time went on, I realized some things were quite sad, disastrous, but it's all the American story, and I wanted to make sure that I did the best job that I could to let the world know what happened down there, beginning in 1838 until 1941. We got a wide range of tours. The historic tour is probably, and the discovery tour is probably a great opportunity for me to talk about the slave ancestors and the saltpeter vats and black men and their contribution to the cave. We all do all the tours, but the historic tours actually allows me to walk in the footsteps of ancestors that were there over 101 years before I ever came there. I see their names and dates along the route, probably at least five along the historic route. And my second cousin, he was a part of the exploring team that found Cathedral Dome in 1906. The things I would really want to do is to let everybody know that Mammoth Cave is a wonderful cave system, internationally renowned. But I want to let people know that people, men and women of color, had a vital role in the success of that in earlier days. I want to make sure that when I'm gone from Mammoth Cave National Park, that the story doesn't go away again. It went away for a while, but I feel that I have opportunity to kind of bring them back, the Bransfords back, hopefully tell in a true, documented, and tasteful way the whole story, the story of slavery, the story of them having happy days escorting kings and queens to the cave. I don't feel my appointment there at Mammoth Cave is just by chance. I really believe that I was meant to be here for a while. At the time that it became a national park, with a lot of Bransfords was there, and if they could hear me and if they could know what I'm trying to do, I just would say to them, I'm doing the best I can in your behalf. I only get to tell the story because of what your accomplishments were. So I hope that my appointment there and the way I tell the story would please you. I wish I could say that to my daddy. My daddy never got to see me come to Mammoth Cave. He died a year before I got in there. So I'd say, fellas, all you Brunswick guides, at one time there were 9 of you on the roster. I want you to know I'm doing the best I can for you. Hope to pick up the torch for a little while.
This is staff folklorist Nancy Gross. On behalf of the American Folklife Center, and with special thanks to AFC intern Joseph Z. Johnson for his help with this episode, thank you for listening to America Works.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour. If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a note. info@laborheritage.org.
Our music today included the Ghetto Boys' Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster from the Office Space soundtrack, and 3 songs from The Return of John Brown: You Can't Hang the Same Man Twice, Land and Freedom, and John Brown's Body.
The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
Today's show is produced by me, Chris Garlock, and engineered by Mighty Mike Nasella and Kalia Chapman right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour,
the art and soul of the American labor movement.
Brown's Body, March 26th, take 4.
John Brown's body is returning to his grave. John Brown showed us all how good folks should behave. John Brown taught us that we've got a lot to say. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Lights to burn as they can move.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Thursday, April 18th. Here are some headlines. Jury selection has resumed in former President Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York City after a break yesterday. But first, a juror who had already been selected was excused after they told the judge overseeing the case that they had developed concerns about their identity becoming public. Jurors' names are not being released publicly. However, Judge Juan Merchan chided the media today for reporting details of jurors' employment and ordered the press not to report about where prospective jurors currently work and used to work going forward. Depending on the speed of jury selection today and possibly tomorrow, Judge Merchan has said opening arguments might begin on Monday. The Senate yesterday voted to dismiss both articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Democrats argued the articles did not identify conduct that met the legal threshold required to impeach. The vote to dismiss the first article was 51-48 along party lines, with Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski voting present. This is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer urging lawmakers to reject the charges.
Madam President, I raise a point of order that impeachment Article 1 does not allege conduct that rises to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor as required under Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, and is therefore unconstitutional.
The vote to dismiss the second charge was 51-49, also along party lines. Mayorkas was only the second cabinet member in U.S. history to be impeached by the House, and the first in nearly 150 years. In other news, the U.S. and the U.K. today imposed new sanctions on Iran, targeting people and organizations associated with Iranian drone production. Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel over the weekend in retaliation for an Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Syria. The U.S. Treasury also sanctioned five Iranian companies involved in steel production and three subsidiaries of an Iranian car maker. In a statement, President Biden said he authorized Treasury Department sanctions, quote, that further degrade Iran's military industries, close quote. Separately, the U.S. Commerce Department issued restrictions on the sale of commercial microelectronics to Iran. U.S. officials earlier this week had warned of impending sanctions. EU leaders also pledged yesterday to issue new sanctions on Iran. And Google fired 28 of its workers yesterday after employees held sit-ins to protest the company's contracts with the Israeli government. The employees were part of a group called No Tech for Apartheid, which opposes the provision of cloud computing called Project Nimbus to the Israeli government. The Google workers organized sit-in demonstrations earlier this week at company locations in New York City, Seattle, and Sunnyvale, California, to protest Project Nimbus. No Tech for Apartheid said the firings were a flagrant act of retaliation and claimed that Google workers, quote, have the right to peacefully protest about terms and conditions of our labor, close quote.